And of course, tonight on Coast to Coast AM, Linda Moulton Howe joins us with some incredible stories. It's her month here to come on with these great stories, and we've got her next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. She heads up earthfiles.com, and she, of course, is our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe. She's got some incredible stories for us. Plus, in the last hour of the program tonight, conversations with Linda, your questions, perhaps stories that you want her to follow through with. We've found many stories that way. Welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe. Hey, Linda, how are you?
Well, George, thanks. And since the last Coast a month ago, I have continued to receive, to say, 100 or more emails about these strange, mysterious, unexplained booms is an understatement. And in fact, last night is a good example of the way things have been going. I started getting a lot of emails about a loud boom in Tucson, Arizona,
yes,
at 7:45 p.m. local time. And some of the headlines that were being sent to me were like this, quote, 911 swamped with calls after reports of a boom over Tucson. The Tucson News reported, we've been inundated with calls from people asking what it was. We've made calls to several law enforcement agencies in Davis, Monthan Air Force Base. And everyone says it was none of their aircraft that caused the sonic boom. Captain Adam Goldberg from Northwest Fire District says his department received about 100 calls in a 15-minute period. And the Pima County Sheriff's Office said, quote, we have no information on the cause of this. We are working on it. And I received an email from somebody right after it happened, and it reads this way. I live in northwest of Tucson, and for the past couple of months, we've been experiencing these very strange booms. I don't know how else to explain them. We just had another right now. I could feel the whole house shake. It was unlike anything I've ever experienced. There was a low rumble along with it. I felt like there were three or four waves of rumbling. My husband had one happen earlier today, but it was much more violent, shorter in duration, and he could feel the percussion impact like an explosion had gone off very close by. And it goes on. Right after that, I started getting emails from San Diego that not only had they had a huge boom that was heard all over the county at 10 a.m. yesterday on the 27th, but that at night, 8:25 p.m., people were reporting three more sort of fast, cracking, loud booms. And then if you just go back one more night to February 26th at 5:30 in Charleston, West Virginia, the people were reporting to TV, to 911, everywhere that the buildings were shaking, including all the people who were in the WOWK 13 TV newsroom.
Strange.
Yeah, they were reporting it. And everybody was describing this boom as something, again, that they had never heard. And I thought this was one of the most interesting descriptions. I thought somebody had cut a tree down and it fell on our building.
Whoa.
We're talking about close, personal, up in your face kinds of sound. I will talk about a couple of others later, but I want to go forward with somebody who got in touch with me after last month's Coast and Earth Files about where I was in the reporting then, and he comes from Louisville, Kentucky. He has asked that he be simply called Peter Jones. He is an emergency medical technician now working in Louisville, but he had been in the Army. He had gone through training. He had been in what was going to be special operations, and he got very badly hurt when heavy equipment fell on his neck and his back and his ankle. And so while he was in medical rehabilitation recovery, it was one day in the summer of 2009 when this happened at Fort Benning, and he was put into rehabilitation, and he ended up in an infantry unit that was preparing to deploy to Iraq. Because of his injuries, he did not go, but he met and talked to an Iraqi vet who described using a new weapons technology referred to as a, quote, sound gun, close quote. I'm not saying this is the answer, but he coming into the context of being in an area where there have been a lot of booms in northwestern Kentucky, something else he's going to tell us in the next half hour that's quite extraordinary, and putting it all together, he's very interested and wanted to share and gave me the permission to share with the Coast audience this information about a sound gun weapon in Iraq. Here now is more from emergency medical technician Peter Jones in Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay. So this would have been in 09, the summer of 09. After my injuries at Fort Bragg, I returned to Fort Benning, what's called needs of the Army, and was assigned to an infantry unit there that was preparing for deployment to Iraq. During said time, I was going through a med board for my injuries. I met a individual there in my platoon who, on his recent test deployment to Iraq, was able to utilize some experimental weapon system, and he showed me pictures of the use of it. Didn't really see any pictures of actual weapon, but what it was capable of and the result injury or death to individuals by the said weapon.
What were you looking at in the photos?
He showed me and a couple other guys. He called us up to his bearish, said, hey, I want to show you pictures of my last deployment. And in this list of his deployment, he came upon these pictures that showed about four different pictures of the use of that weapon. And he explained what it was and how he came upon using it. And apparently it was a vehicle-mounted weapon system that was using infrared targeting systems. And he was on a mission for what's called an HVT, or high-value target. They located this individual and dispatched this weapon against him. In the pictures, you see, he explained the weapon as a sound gun or a sound weapon. In the pictures, you see a wall with a hole in it about the size of a basketball, and it's blown through your typical Iraqi home, kind of a brick and stucco application. So you see this perfect round hole in the wall looking inside out at this hole. And then the next image was from a corner of the room where this hole was in a wall, and you see just a rather plush Iraqi home, well-furnished. You see the hole on one side, and on the other side, you see an overstuffed armchair with a lot of blood around it on the floor. The following picture is a picture of the actual chair showing just a large amount of blood, pretty much nothing else there, just blood, and maybe looks like some different tissue there, but nothing real discernible. And then the final image was from overhead, and the only discernible object other than it being a big blood spot was a heart. He called it human heart behind the chair. So this sound wave was activated, fired through the wall, hit this individual, and essentially liquefied him except for his heart.
Did he describe that there was any sound associated with this sound gun?
He didn't relate any.
Did he explain how sound was doing this?
Yeah, I asked him if he knew how it worked. And he really didn't know. They were just giving it to use and see how effective it was in its use. And from what I understand, it was very effective. And this wasn't the only mission they used it on.
This was not the only mission they used it on.
That's correct.
Can you describe the physical shape about this weapon that is mounted on a vehicle?
He didn't have any pictures of the weapon or the vehicle or anything. In the military, what we do, we run a mission, especially when we have a high-value target, is once we eliminate this threat, we go in and we investigate the whole home. We're looking for pertinent intelligence, anything that would render more intelligence from that individual's location. And so part of that process is just taking pictures. And it looked like that this was part of that series of pictures that he would use to investigate from inside the homes. So there was no pictures of the weapon system or the vehicle that the weapon was mounted on, just very catastrophic effect that the weapon had. And any conventional type weapon system that may have been used other than a sound weapon or something unknown to me would have had a lot more collateral damage. There would have been destruction to the remainder of the room. So this was very different in appearance.
This was a surgical strike by an experimental sound gun that was able to take human tissue, bone, and everything, liquefy it right there on the spot, leaving only the human heart as residue.
In this individual, yes. In fact, see a picture of nothing but a pool of blood, maybe some tissue, and intact human heart. I've seen several in my studies here at school, and this was a human heart. I'm certain of that.
Did he have any explanation in any briefing or even off-the-record conversation with anyone about how the sound could do this so surgically and why would the human heart be left?
He didn't. If he did, he didn't say anything about it. A couple of weeks after that, I was telling my dad about the situation. He was also a veteran, and he was really interested in seeing a picture. So I asked an individual there in my platoon for the pictures at that time, but he never sent them to me. So that was really the last he said anything of it to me.
So you do not have the photos?
I do not.
As somebody who is training in medical work, what is your speculation about why the human heart at the center of the mediastinum, the chest, would be the only tissue left not liquefied?
If I just had to guess, the heart is essentially able to conduct its own electrical activity. So if that electrical activity in the heart was able to protect the heart from these disrupting sound waves, that's the only way I can think. Either that or maybe quite possibly there was some sort of cavitation in a sound wave where the weapon was aimed or directed to the center of mass and went around the heart. Didn't affect the heart, but everything around it.
Mm-hmm.
These are guesses that I've thought about. It stumped me since he showed them to me. But we do know that essentially we are held together by how our subatomic particles are vibrating. And so if sound wave, which is light just slowed down, mm-hmm. was able to disrupt these vibrations, we could essentially come apart. I don't know why the heart would be left untouched, though.
Now, this was 2009 summer, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And did he tell you how many times he knew himself that this sound gun had been used on people?
They had it for the whole deployment, and they used it throughout the whole deployment, but he didn't give a number.
Was he working in some special ops group?
You know, as infantrymen, we often find ourselves working hand in hand with Special Operations Command, whether it be in a quick reaction force, supporting role. They use us when they need fighters in numbers. So this could very well be the case. I mean, he didn't say that he was with Army, Navy, or Marine Special Forces. However, he did say that he was tasked with using experimental weapons to evaluate their effectiveness throughout the deployment.
Did he describe who came and took the photos from him and who analyzed the scene?
He did not relate anything to that effect.
And if that was 2009 and you and I are speaking in February of 2013, have you had any other evidence from anyone else that this sound gun is still being used in some kind of war context right now?
I have not. That was the first and last I had heard of it.
And probably in use now.
The only reason why I would think it would not be in use is if by vast majority it was decided that it was inhumane or inappropriate to use in any kind of scenario. But to the best of my judgment, as effective as that weapon was that I saw through pictures, it would certainly be used because it eliminates collateral damage.
Do you think it would make sound, or would it be silent because the frequency was outside of human hearing?
That's just it. It just depends on the level of frequency that it would be using. And if I had to guess, it would be an ultrasound or high-frequency sound, or even infrasound, which is a very low-frequency sound, both of which have effects on the human body, but human ear cannot hear.
And I would like to ask the Coast and the Earth Files audiences that if anyone has firsthand information about the mysterious unexplained booms that have been going on for about 2 years now throughout the United States, and any possible link to something like the sound gun weaponry or any other experimental weapon, I wish you would call, email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Always think of a reporter who files news about the Earth. So you can always reach me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And all requests for confidentiality are honored, as I have done with this person. And
Linda, let me also pass on real quickly to you, too, that Luke Air Force Base is telling everybody out in the Tucson area that one of its jets broke the sound barrier, and that's why everybody was rattled and shaken. That's a pretty big sound barrier blast to me, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't buy it. I know that the one in San Diego a year ago covered 100 square miles. And now this big expanse of one. You know, we've had these booms reported simultaneously in five counties at once in Georgia and huge expanses of area. And remember also, there is something peculiar about what has happened the last 2 years in this way. When you go back to Clintonville, Wisconsin, and the mayor that I interviewed right after she had been out with all of the fire and 911 and police and everyone, and there had been a series of booms, remember?
Mm-hmm. I remember.
And in the interview, and that morning, she stressed that she had felt those booms herself and that it came up against the bottom of her feet. It even hurt her shin bone. And she said, it's like something is exploding below our feet. Those sorts of descriptions were going on until approximately June of 2012, the summer, not quite a year ago. Then it seemed to me that there was a shift in descriptions in which there were more people saying it's definitely above. It feels like pressure in the air. The people have said, it's like an invisible war above me. And what is happening here is not easily explainable. And I think that everybody should understand that in the vast majority, of which there are hundreds, I have a map now of all the regions where all of these have been being reported. And the vast majority, there's still no explanation today. And very interestingly, there was yesterday, I did an interview with, he's a businessman. He doesn't want to be identified either, but I talked to him at great length. He lives on Merritt Island, Florida, which is straight east of Orlando and only 4 miles from the Kennedy Space Center. He's been there long enough to have heard what it sounds like when the shuttle takes off or if the shuttle was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not quite a month ago, February 2nd, it was the early evening, we're not talking late evening, and just about after dusk, and he said there was such a loud explosion or boom, and living close to the Kennedy Space Center, he had never heard anything like it. In fact, here's a quote. I've seen and experienced a lot of weird, unexplained things, but had never heard anything like this before, and not without knowing the source. It's odd that as frequent as these booms appear to be happening in different parts of the country, there is not more public information or at least news coverage. I hear this a lot now. I'm not letting go of this story. And when we come back after the break, I'm going to hear more and share with you from Peter Jones about an extraordinary event that happened in Louisville that he thinks is connected to the booms in that part of the country.
Happening all over the place. We'll be back with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. And in a moment, Linda will follow up on this bizarre story of these huge booms being heard all around the country. We'll try to follow up on this. Hey, our television show is Beyond Belief, a future program. We'll try to get Linda Moulton Howe on to talk about cattle mutilations. She's an expert in that arena as well. You can see Beyond Belief Fridays, 7 o'clock Eastern Time. It is internet-based. You get 10 days free. Simply go to our website up there at coasttocoastam.com. Click hosts. The TV icon opens up. Take advantage of it. You get to see all kinds of videos and the TV show on the program tomorrow night. The Great Witch Fiona Horne is my guest. Make sure you're part of that program. We'll be back in a moment. More with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda. Even if the Tucson case was a fighter jet that broke the sound barrier, how does that explain all the booms all over the country?
It does not.
Nope.
We've got 2 years of this phenomena, and in addition to the loud booming sound that one security camera in Salem, Massachusetts got I think it was January 5th, 2013, you hear, well, the first thing I think that you see is this flash of white light, and then, whoo, there's a huge cracking boom, and there was no weather. There was no weather of any kind for 72 hours on either side of that night. Now, so we've got the bright flashes of light in many cases, and we also have following either the day after or within days of these events, one or more military helicopters show up doing search grids low over houses. And there have been two dramatic recent examples of these low searching military helicopters a few days after loud unexplained booms. And these both occurred mid-January 2013 in Louisville, Kentucky, where Peter Jones is, and Cedar Hills, Utah, where James and Amy Brown are. They live there. And that was my report a month ago on Coast with them talking about the series of booms, multiple light flashes, the house shaking, and they had seen the triangle of orange lights outside of their house about 5 days before the booms and these lights started. And tonight, I'm going to go in more detail about the helicopters that showed up at his place in Cedar Hills. But first, I would like to return to Peter Jones, the EMT, now in Louisville, Kentucky. He continues with information that goes now beyond the sound gun technology used in Iraq to his shock in mid-January as he stood at his home and he watched for 15 minutes an Army Apache helicopter flying at and below treetop level over the houses in his neighborhood. And this is after the January 7 to 8 booms have been reported all over northwestern Kentucky, southwestern Indiana, and southeastern Illinois. And during that same time period, without either part of the country knowing, in Cedar Hills, Utah, they were experiencing the lights, the booms, and the helicopters there. Here now in Louisville, Kentucky, is Peter Jones.
I haven't personally heard any mysterious booms or crashes of light in my experience that was unexplainable. However, I live about 20 miles from Fort Knox as the crow flies, and we do see a lot of military activity. You know, I grew up in the area, so before the armor school left Fort Knox and went to Fort Benning, you knew when they were out in the field training because 20, 30 miles away, you could still hear these tanks and artillery weapons being utilized.
But you have heard about all of these unexplained and mysterious booms that have been reported even in Kentucky in your area over the past 2 years and all over the United States.
I have. Certainly, I'm an avid coast-to-coast listener.
In the context of you hearing about unexplained mysterious booms in my reporting at Earth Files and on Coast for the past 2 years, can you please talk about a recent incident that left you wondering what was happening?
I live in a residential area of the suburbs of Louisville, Kentucky. I was coming home from a clinical day at the local hospital between 1 and 3 in the afternoon. I pulled into my drive. I got out to enter my home and heard the very distinct thump of rotor wash from a military aircraft. I grew up with a father who was an avid aircraft enthusiast and a trained air traffic controller. So anytime we saw an aircraft coming overhead, he'd be like, okay, what kind of aircraft is that? And this is how you identify it. So anyway, I can discern between the helicopters that, say, a news agency uses, the police use, fighter stat care use, and this was military. So I looked up, that's really loud, louder than normal. because we occasionally have military aircraft flying overhead in transit from one location to the next. But this was unusual and different this time. And as I was looking up, I caught some movement out of the corner of my eye, and I turned to look at it. It was the main rotor structure of an H-64 Apache helicopter, and I could only see the main rotor because as he banked in a turn, his rotors were coming over top of the trees and the ridge line of the homes as he banked. So this means he was very low, and he wasn't far away on the horizon because the size of the rotor that I saw and the part of the fuselage that I saw was very large.
And was it at tree level?
It was literally at tree level or just a little below. And this guy was in my neighborhood doing what we call map of the earth, which means following the contour of the earth to a vague radar. That's a military technique in enemy territory. And the first thing I thought, that guy's doing map of the earth in the neighborhood. He's showing off. He must live here. But as I watched him, he maintained this search pattern back and forth, slowly banking, kind of circuitous pattern, slowly moving off to the northeast.
So you were recognizing a pattern that you were familiar with from a military operation that would be trying to avoid radar, but at the same time searching for something that from your point of view would have to be invisible.
Yeah, that's correct. When I was actually stationed at Fort Bragg, when we were out in the field doing training, we were always, you know, surrounded by these Apache, Kiowa, and Black Hawk helicopters, where these pilots were doing trainings at the same time as we were in the same location, and they would come in the very same manner, flying over terrain features, coming in low, hitting the ground, raising up constantly all day long, flying in and out over a military installation in a designated training area for that function, not a residential area.
Is it legal under any circumstances for any of our military operations to be flying at treetop level or below treetop level over any residential area of the United States?
To the best of my understanding, the FAA has a precedent set of what's called a 500-foot ceiling for any aircraft outside of, I think it's called a Class A airspace, which is over your major airports where they are actually coming in to land, where you cannot break that 500-foot ceiling and come below that. And if that's correct, this goes for military, civilian, whoever. This guy was clearly violating that regulation and was well below that hard ceiling.
How long do you think that low flying in a grid pattern looking for something went on?
I stood there for a good 15 minutes watching this guy. And near towards the end of him kind of flying off into the distance in that pattern, he never got any higher. He maintained that grid pattern until I couldn't see or hear him. It was a good 15 minutes, and right as he was about to fly off, man, I need to get my phone out and get a picture of this. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get a picture or video of it, and I was kind of looking around to see if anybody else was seeing it, but no one else was out, you know, because this is the mid-afternoon, and everybody's at work.
Did you try to call either Fort Knox or the local National Guard to see if they would have any explanation for why a large military helicopter would be flying at or below treetop level in your neighborhood?
Well, initially I thought, you know, I need to check into this. I need to call somebody. If they were out there doing something like training, or if they were doing something that was supposed to be under the radar, no pun intended, then they wouldn't relate that fact to me. So my neighbor, he is actually an infantry commander for a unit there in Fort Knox. And I kind of talked to him about it, and he was baffled by the situation.
And baffled means that he had no understanding of why and had no context in his military career for explaining such low-level helicopter flight over a Kentucky home residence for at least 15 minutes.
That's correct. You know, here's an individual who's had multiple combat theaters, infantry commander, we're talking infantry officer, who has higher than secret clearance, who is privy to a multitude of training exercises, including close air support. has never heard of anything like that being utilized or even the need to utilize training over a residential area. Only time that we would need to train over residential areas if we were going to be fighting in a residential area.
Did the two of you speculate as military people about why this would be happening?
My neighbor, I think he thought that it was probably someone showing off for somebody, and if his commander finds out, he'll be in a lot of trouble. I myself speculated to him and related to him these other incidences around the nation that I'd heard about from Earth Files and Coast to Coast. And he, at that point, he didn't have anything to say. He was just blown away and really didn't know why in the world we would be flying over residential areas.
Right.
The fact that this aircraft was so low doing these maneuvers, no matter how long you've been flying in that manner or how good of a pilot you are, there's always a very high risk, especially in a residential area where there's power lines and all kinds of overhead obstructions, of a collision or an accident causing this aircraft to come down. And when a helicopter comes down, it doesn't glide down. It doesn't have a gliding surface. They have rotors that are constantly fighting to keep it in the air. When those stop spinning, that aircraft is going to fall out of the sky. This guy's doing that over residential areas. He loses lift over those rotor surfaces at any point. He's going to fall out of the sky and into these homes. And that's pretty significant. That's why we have defined areas to train with those type of aircraft. I personally feel that it was more a training type mission, but there's also the chance that there was some unseen or unknown threat that they were trying to engage or locate. You know, that's the only reason why they would use that type of activity, either trying to evade some kind of radar to sneak up on a target or object so that they can engage that target or object, or just training to do that. But I don't understand why we would do it in a residential areas. We've just had conflicts in residential areas in Iraq, yet we didn't have them training in America over residential locations to do those type of missions. And we have places at Fort Knox, Fort Campbell, Fort Bragg, Fort Benning that look like mock cities, mock villages. I mean, you go in, they have everything from sewer systems to lighting. All of your transportation type things are located. I mean, it looks like you're in Iraq. So if that's the case, why don't we utilize those to train over, especially when it's so dangerous to use those type of aircraft in that manner over a residential area? So I personally believe that this most likely was a training event, but training for what? You train like you fight like you trained. So it scares me to think that, hey, NDAA was just recently passed with the stipulation still included that the military has authority to operate in our cities and in our homes and in our towns. And now here they are flying in these manners dangerously around our homes. I mean, that's how I feel that this is a part of. I believe it's training for something coming up that they anticipate. That's real scary to think about.
Interesting twist to the whole story, Linda, huh?
Well, yes. And now, George, let's go 1,600 miles west to Cedar Hills, Utah. It's exactly the same time period between January 7th to 10th, 2013. 7th and 8th of January is where there were booms reported all over that tri-state area of Indiana, Kentucky, and Illinois. The 8th through the 10th is when booms, light flashes were being reported in Cedar Hills and all the way by other people up in Ogden, but completely separate. That's two mountain ranges north of Cedar Hills. And where Jim and Amy Brown had heard the booms, had been startled and scared at night twice by the white light flashes, no weather, completely still nights, but big bright light flashes at their windows. Their child, the youngest child, couldn't go to sleep. And within about 3 or 4 days after that, Jim had called me and emailed me, and I had talked with him on the phone. And the very next day, what showed up is this. Quote, a helicopter came flying very low to the ground, less than 200 to 300 feet over the homes in the neighborhood, moving at a very fast pace. Often the flight pattern would consist of circling the neighborhood and then leaving the vicinity, only to return minutes later with a search type of pattern over the adjacent mountainside directly east of our neighborhood. The helicopter search techniques appeared to be extremely aggressive, reminiscent of a military-style search and rescue tactic. Flying over an area and then looping back and diving on a location, pulling up and hovering at treetop level for 5 to 10 seconds, and then diving again. This diving action was repeated around 15 times over areas of the mountainside right next to where our houses are. On two occasions, while observing this from my front yard, I also noticed a second helicopter at very high altitude, slowly circling as if monitoring from above. It was too high to be heard or identified, but the helicopter that was performing the low-level maneuvers was at times very close to me. It was black without markings, nothing written or artistic. It had completely blacked out windows. It is a medium-sized helicopter with a large engine compartment on top. It had what appeared to be an addition to its belly that was white-shaped, similar to a dull hull of a boat, with a mount in the center that appeared to be a 2-foot circular encasing distinctive to what I have seen search and rescue helicopters use for infrared camera mounts. Now, he went to the internet. He tried to find a match for these helicopters that he saw several times repeatedly right over the houses where there had been the booms, and he has not been able to find an exact match to this helicopter. And I would like to have the Coast listening audience go to earthfiles.com on my headlines page, and the reports for each of the half hours tonight are there, and it's very important. I would like people to go to this particular one about the helicopters flying so low, because I went to the Federal Aviation Administration website. I studied it quite a bit. I have a summary that tells about what are the low-flying aircraft rules and how do you file to the FAA low-flying aircraft complaints. And in the section having to do with these rules, it says over other than congested areas in altitude of 500 feet above the surface, except over open water or sparsely populated areas, this is the general rule. But there is a qualifier for helicopters. Helicopters may be operated at less than the minimums prescribed in the paragraphs above if the operation is conducted without hazard to persons or property on the surface. In addition, each person operating a helicopter shall comply with any routes or altitudes specifically prescribed for helicopters by the FAA administrator. That doesn't answer a lot of the questions, and it certainly doesn't answer an Army vet's concern that what he was watching for 15 minutes and Jim Hill and Cedar Hills was lower at times than treetops. And if it's evasion or if it's action because there's an enemy, what is the invisible enemy? And even if there was training like this, why would they be risking the possibility of crashing into house roofs?
It's an amazing story, Linda. We'll be back in a moment as we continue talking next about Bigfoot research.